If you're new with us, my name is Dave. We're so glad to have you. We started a new series last week, which I'm really excited to talk to you about. It's the seven I am statements that Jesus made about himself in the Gospel of John. And they are so wild and so audacious and so big. And historically, people have made audacious claims throughout the years. I mean, if you think about pop stars and movie stars and politicians and athletes, all of history, there are people who are making big claims about themselves. In fact, I don't know if you remember this. I wasn't alive yet, but some of you were, when John Lennon of the Beatles made a very audacious claim about the Beatles. Do you guys remember what that was? They were bigger than who? The answer is always in church. This is one answer, guys. It's Jesus, right? That's the answer to everything, right? They were bigger than Jesus. And you remember, if you watch those, or you go back and watch that footage, John Lennon, after he did that, you know, people were so blown away that you're claiming to be bigger than Jesus and how sacrilegious and, you know, just how audacious that was. And if you watch the kind of the interviews afterwards, you see John Lennon kind of trying to rewind the tape a little bit and say, well, that's not really what I meant. And, you know, you kind of took me the wrong way. And he was backpedaling as best as he could. But when Jesus made the big audacious claims about himself, he never backpedaled. He never said, you guys got it wrong. You guys misunderstood me. You guys took this out of proportion. He didn't do that because he was very, very clear on who he was. And he was big and bold and audacious for a reason. But that was Jesus. In fact, C.S. Lewis says, if you just listen to Jesus' words, you can't help but walk away with three different options you're left with. And the options aren't, you know, he was a good teacher or he was just a moral man. The three options that we're left with, because Jesus was so clear and so big and so bold on his claims about himself, that he is either a liar, a lunatic, or he must be Lord. And so we invite you, if you're kind of wrestling with the whole Jesus thing, to wrestle with Jesus' own words of who he claimed to be in this series. And so last week we started this series and we said that Jesus made this claim that he was the bread of life. And you really need to understand the context to understand just how big and bold that statement was. But the context was, as Mike Tabor was mentioning up here, that Jesus fed thousands upon thousands of people with bread. And so the context all revolved around this bread. But it was more than just this idea of bread. It went all the way back to the idea when Israel was fed in the wilderness, this manna, this bread of heaven. For 40 years, God sustained them in the wilderness. And Jesus, in that context, says, you know, you think that was good bread. I am the true bread of heaven. And that just kind of blew everybody away. And so to understand, you know, what Jesus is saying in these big statements, you have to understand that there's a context to these statements, and there's these word pictures that he gives. And these word pictures are given because people in that day did not think in bullet points. They didn't think in terms of, you know, pithy little kind of statements. They thought in terms of word pictures. And so Jesus gives them these incredibly audacious word pictures of I am this and I am that. And so we're moving on to the second one this morning, and John says Jesus, after declaring that he was the bread of life, would go on from there, and here was his second big, audacious, bold claim about himself in John. Here's what he says next in John 8:12. He says, when Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Now, If you're not obviously a first century listener, you don't have to be a first century Jew to understand this was a big, bold claim. I mean, even just for 21st century American, very scientific understanding of how the world works kind of thing, we understand this is a bold claim. Because for us, what is the light of the world? What gives light to the world? The sun, right? And if you think about the sun for a moment, the sun is both wonderful and wonderfully dangerous, right? So the sun, for us, as we know, is the source of life, right? We know we live in the Goldilocks zone now. The first century Jews didn't understand any of this, but we live in the Goldilocks zone in our solar system. If we were a little bit too far away from the sun, we get too cold. If we get a little too close, we get too hot. We all know this, but the sun is the source of life for us. We know this. We also know the sun is the source of truth in the sense of, It gives us light that we see because of light. We see these protons bouncing off, reflecting, and that's how we are able to see. We would have no sense of direction if the sun was gone. We would be in pitch black and we wouldn't know what to do. And so it's the source of truth, but it's also the source, if you think about it, of our comfort and joy in some ways. Right? We know how important it is, especially this time of the year. We're getting out of that seasonal depression of having months of darkness, and it's Daylight Savings Day today. Anybody happy about that? Woo! Right? The sun's going to be out longer. Hey, we made it. Another winter deep depression is gone. You know, the sun's going to be out longer, and it's going to be great. And we just know, just today in our 21st century scientific studies, you know, we know how important sunshine is to the body and vitamin D. And we've done study after study of people who have to spend months in darkness up north. And we just know how important it is for our joy, right? Just to get us out of depression. I remember going to California, right, last month and just having those couple days of warm California sun hit my face. Oh, it just filled me with something that Ohio sun in February just cannot do, right? And so we are drawing closer to the sun, and it is wonderful. And so it gives us joy. But it's not just joy, it gives us comfort, if you think about it. In fact, how many of you are afraid of the dark? Well, let me just put that to the test right now, all right? Now, it's not completely dark, but what do you do when your kid is afraid of the dark at night? What is the only real comfort that it's going to provide to your child? You just can't say, hey, just go back to bed, it's fine. What do you normally have to do if they're afraid of the dark? You have to do what? Turn the light on for a moment at least, right? Oh. And they're comforted. It's like, oh. You know, it's unsettling being in the dark for a period of time. It's unsettling. And so it gives us a sense of comfort and joy. So it's wonderful. But we know that unmediated, unfiltered light is also incredibly dangerous for us, right? We know that if you stare at the sun for more than just even a half a second, your retinas begin to burn. We've all been in that position where we got out in the sun and we didn't have protection and we ended up getting sunburns that we're not proud of. And it's not just a physical danger, right? There's an emotional aspect to this too. I remember in high school, waking up every single morning because I had terrible acne. I woke up every single morning just to count how many new pimples had sprung forth from the night before, right? And some of you have to deal with that, you know? And so how many more pimples do I have to pop this morning? And the brighter the light, the more, you know, harsh it was to see just how I really looked in the mirror. And it was just kind of like off-putting. I didn't want that bright light because the brighter the light, the more I could see myself for what I really look like. And so we know, I mean, just our 21st century American scientific, we know if that's all that Jesus was saying, like he was like the sun, we could spend the rest of our time talking about how Jesus is the source of life, the source of truth, the source of joy and comfort, and how in a sense kind of dangerous it is to approach Jesus. And the closer we get to him and the more his light shines on us, the more revealing our lives look. But it's way more than that when you read the text. See, even though the Jewish first century listener hearing these words for the first time, even though they didn't know all the things about the sun that we do, you have to understand what Jesus was saying when he claimed to be the light of the world was even more audacious than what our 21st century minds can even kind of wrap around just by thinking about the sun. In fact, John, when he records this, says something so interesting a little bit later on. He adds this little detail about just how people, you know, thought about this or what your expectations were when they heard this. It's so interesting. Here's what he says. He says, he spoke these words while teaching in the temple courts near the place where the offerings were put. Yet, he says, no one seized him because his hour had not yet come. In other words, John says, listen, as a first century Jewish reader, you're reading this and going, oh my goodness, you would expect Jesus, after declaring, I am the light of the world, to be grabbed, to be seized, to be arrested. I mean, John's like, you would think that would happen. That would be the expectation, and yet no one seized him. So why would John add this? Why would it be that people would expect Jesus to be arrested at this point after declaring himself to be just the light of the world? What was Jesus really, really claiming when he said this, when he claimed, I am the light of the world? Well, to understand just how audacious this statement was, you have to understand two very important things: where Jesus was and when Jesus was. So the question is, where is Jesus when he says this? Well, John tells us that he's in the temple court near the offerings, where they took the offerings and placed the offerings. That meant that he was in the court of women. That's where the court was. So if you understand the Jewish temple system, you had the outward, you know, where the Gentiles hung out, and then it became more and more restrictive as you got closer to the Holy of Holies. So then you had the court of women, then you had the court of men, then you had the court of priests, all becoming more and more restrictive. So the court of women, a lot of people hanging out there, big open space for Jesus to proclaim, I am the light of the world. Now, on any other day, that would have meant so much. I mean, on a normal day, that would have not meant nearly as what it meant the day that Jesus made it. So that was where Jesus was, but when is Jesus? When is Jesus when he says this? This is the key. John actually gives us a hint, or tells us where Jesus is and when Jesus is. In fact, here's what he says again. He says, when Jesus spoke again to the people. So when Jesus spoke again, meaning that this conversation was an ongoing conversation, that this was something that Jesus started earlier on. And so when was this earlier on? John tells us. So you got to rewind the tape back to John chapter 7 to find out when Jesus is saying these words. And John, if you rewind the tape to chapter 7, here's what John says. Here's when this was took place: on the last and greatest day of the festival. So the question is, when is Jesus? And the answer is, he is at the temple court, the last night of a festival called the Feast of Tabernacles, or the Festival of Tabernacles. So let me explain again. Jesus is in the court of women, the last night of the Festival of Tabernacles. And he stands up and says, I am the light of the world. You know, I don't hear any audible gasps in the audience today here. Why? Because we often, most of us don't understand what this means, why this is so important. And that's okay, that's job security for me. So let me explain. Let me explain about the Festival of Tabernacles. The Feast or Festival of Tabernacles was one of the three main pilgrimages that the Jews were commanded to take to Jerusalem every single year. You had three of them. You had Passover, you had Pentecost, which was the Feast of Weeks, and then you had the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, the Feast of Tabernacles was during the time of harvest, and it was a great time of celebration. It was to commemorate God's provision for them in the wilderness. Again, remember, the Jews were taken out of Egypt before they get to the Promised Land. 40 years they spent in the wilderness, in the desert. We think of wilderness as woods and forests. This was just desert. And we think, well, how in the world can you live in the desert? Well, God had to provide for them every single day. And so this was to commemorate God's provision for them, how God provided for them, how God took care of them every single day in that wandering year. So this feast was a way for God to help them to keep their memory alive of God's provision, of their dependence on God. And so this lasted, this took place about, it was a 7-day period. And so Jews from all over would just pour in to Jerusalem. And they would do, the reason why it's called the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles is because they would create these tents out of these palm branches or myrtle branches or olive branches. They would either bring them with them or buy them there. And they would create these tents. And they would live in these tents for the week. And these tents would actually have a little opening in the top center so they could kind of see it in the sky. And again, this was all to remember how God provided and cared for them and how they lived in tents all these 40 years. And so this was an incredible celebration. And it took place 7 days, and kids absolutely loved it. You can imagine, you know, it's like, okay, family, we're going to go to Jerusalem, and we're going to live in a tent for 7 weeks, right? And the kids absolutely loved it. And the parents, you know, loved it too, because this was a celebration. This was a chance to kind of rest, a kind of party, to dance, to sing, just to reflect on, again, God's provision for them over the last year, because it was harvest time and God provided once again. And so this was just a really incredibly joyous time for the people of Israel to just come into Jerusalem, flood Jerusalem, live in these little tent makeshift things and just have a lot of fun. But during this time, every day, there would be certain activities performed. One of them was the procession of the priests. The priests would lead this procession down to the Pool of Siloam. And the Pool of Siloam was this pool that was fed by the Spring of Gihon. And so the Spring of Gihon would flow down and you know, fill this Pool of Siloam. And this pool was a spring water, so it was called living water. And every single day, the priest would lead the procession. He would grab a golden pitcher, and he would lead the procession down to the Pool of Siloam, and he would scoop up a pitcher of water from the Pool of Siloam. And then they would sing, and there would be music all the way down and all the way back, and they would be singing and, you know, the celebration. And he would lead them back up to the altar, and he would pour this living water out on the altar. And they would do this every single day as a way for two things: to celebrate the fact that when God took them out into the wilderness, God provided for them water from the rock, and how God provided for them, not just in the wilderness, but God had provided for them every day since, right? They've had water, and this is also a prayer that God would continue to provide that water for them for the next year. And so every single day they would do this. On the last day, it was even more spectacular because they would go down, get the pitcher of water, they would go up, and this processional then would kind of march around the altar 7 times to remember how they marched around Jericho 7 times before the walls fell. And then the offering was poured, and it was just a great time of singing, God save us, God, you know, bless us with water. And it was in this moment that Jesus stood up, John tells us. And this, Jesus stood up and said in a loud voice, "Let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as Scripture has said, rivers of living water will flow from within them." In other words, you think that, you know, you're praying that God would give you this living water from this, you know, pitcher, and this would give you water for the next year. Listen, if you come to me, streams of living water will come forth, and you will never thirst again. Do you see how having context helps us understand just how powerful these statements are that Jesus makes, knowing what was going on around him? And so to understand this Feast of Tabernacles, you have to understand that this water procession took place every morning, but something also occurred every single night. There would be these 4 massive lamps that were lit every single night in the court of women. In fact, the Mishnah actually describes to us just how big and impressive the light was that they would light. It says this: towards the end of the first day, or the Feast of the Tabernacles, people went down into the court of the women. Golden lamps were there, and 4 golden bowls were on each of them, and 4 ladders were by each. 4 young men, because we're going to send the young guys to do this, 4 young guys from the priestly group of youths had jugs of oil in their hands containing about 120 logs and poured oil from them into the individual bowls. Wicks were made from discarded trousers of the priests and from their girdles. There was, check this out, no court in Jerusalem that was not bright from the light of the place of drawing water. It's like, whoa, this lit up the whole city. Men of piety, known for their good works, danced before them, the crowd with torches in their hands, and sang before them songs and praises. So they would light these massive lamps, and this would go on all night long, and there would be singing and dancing. But what did this light represent? Why would they light such huge lights? Well, if you remember the wilderness, right? God provided manna, God provided water, But these lights were lit to remember how God provided light for them. You remember how God provided light? How did God provide the light? Well, he tells us that as soon as they left Egypt, there was a light that showed up, a pillar. In fact, here's how it's described. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. And so they left Egypt, and they followed this pillar of cloud, which provided direction for them, but not just direction, it provided protection, shade for them. As you can imagine, the desert sun is just incredibly hot, and so this provided shade for them as they traveled during the day, and then by night, they gave warmth because the pillar of fire. So you need to understand, you need three things when you live out in the desert, right? You need food, and God provided the manna. You need water, and God provided the water from the rock. But you also need some sort of protection. You need light. You need light. You need heat. You need those kind of things. And so, how did God provide for that? How did he do it? It was through this pillar of cloud and pillar of fire. And so you see them being led by this, and then they get to Mount Sinai, and this pillar of cloud comes over Mount Sinai, and it's thundering, lightning, and it's absolutely terrifying. And then they set up the tabernacle system, and it hovered over the tabernacle. Every time they would need to move, the cloud would lift, and they would follow the cloud. And every time they needed to settle down, the cloud would settle down, and they just got their cues from this cloud. And then when they built the temple, we're told that 1 Kings, Solomon, chapter 8 goes, oh my goodness, God, we're so blessed to have you here. And he makes this incredible prayer, and the cloud comes and fills the temple to the point where all the other priests kind of begin to run away because they can't do their priestly duties. They're like, we got to get out of here. It's just filling the temple. So what was this pillar of cloud and pillar of fire? What was it? It was God's glory. It was God's Shekinah glory, God's special presence with the people of Israel, leading them, protecting them, guiding them, giving them everything they need to survive in the wilderness. And so, Jesus, last night, the lights are on, right? The lights are lit. But you know what? At some point, you know, this must have been a bittersweet day for the Israel. It's always a bittersweet day because it was the last day, right? It was the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles. It was the last night these lights were going to be on. And so it must have been bittersweet because sweet meaning they would have just probably partied a little bit harder that night in a sense of sang harder, danced a little longer, stayed up a little later because it was the last night before the festival was over. But it had to be bitter too, if you think about it. Just like every last night of something, like the last night when Christmas is over and you got to take the lights down. That's always kind of a sad time. It's like, oh, we put all this work and effort, now it's Christmas is over. And when they extinguished those lights for the last time, it had to be a reminder. It had to be a reminder for them of just how empty the temple was, just how dark the temple was. A reminder that God's presence was not there any longer. They had to be reminded of Ezekiel's words and, you know, in his prophecy, how he saw the glory of the Lord depart from the temple. He declared Ichabod on the temple. God's glory departed. There was no cloud. There was no pillar of fire. There was no, you know, special presence like it was back in the day. And it must have been just bitter sweet. And the question, I'm sure, on their minds would have been, when those lights, those giant lights finally went out for the last time, when would God's glory ever come back? When was God ever going to fill our temple again? When was God going to show up and reveal himself in these powerful ways? When was he going to do that again? And again, it's in this context that Jesus steps on the scene. And we don't know if the lights were still on, if the lights had gone out, but here's Jesus coming up, declaring in front of these giant lamps, I in the light of the world. I am the glory light. I was actually the pillar of cloud and pillar of fire that led you out of Egypt and protected you and guided you and warmed you at night. I was the cloud that descended upon Mount Sinai. I was the thing that hovered over the tabernacle and gave you direction and guidance. I was the glory in the temple that day of Solomon. He says, I am the light of the world. And you've been looking and you've been waiting and you've been wondering, when was this light going to come back? But that light was simply a reflection, a light that was temporary. He says, I have come in a fuller, better way. I am the glory of God. I am the light of the world. Now, can you see why John in that moment said, and when Jesus said this, nobody arrested him. We were all shocked as you. Nobody grabbed him. Nobody seized him because of what he was claiming that night. He wasn't just claiming to be like the sun. He was claiming to be God himself, the glory of God. And then Jesus, again, says, whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. He's saying this, just like Israel followed the pillar of cloud and pillar of fire, just as they took their cues every single day from that pillar, I want you to follow me. And if you read Numbers 9, it's insane how faithful the Israelites were to follow this cloud. When the cloud rested, they rested. And so you can imagine, you pack up everything, you're following the cloud. The cloud settles, you unpack everything, and how many of us love moving and unpacking? You gotta unpack everything, and you don't know if you're gonna pack up the next day or the next month or the next year. And Numbers 9 tells us there'll be times where they unpack everything and only to be seeing the cloud go up again the next day, it's like, oh, we gotta pack up everything and move the next day. How frustrating would that be? And then other times it says they sometimes unpacked and the cloud would just rest for a year. And it's like, when are we going to move again, God? When are we going to like go, you know, you said the promised land, it's been a year and we haven't moved an inch. And Jesus is saying, listen, I'm calling you to follow me like the Israelites followed that pillar of cloud and pillar of fire. That when you faithfully follow me, when you take your cues from me, you will never walk in darkness. By the way, have you ever walked in darkness? It's horrible. It's unpleasant at best. I mean, it's terrifying because you don't know where you're stepping. You know, I've been out camping and I've just been out playing when the lights just all, you know, kind of gone off and didn't have a flashlight. And you're kind of stumbling and fumbling your way back home. And you can get hit, you can trip, you can fall, and you don't know what you're tripping over. You don't know what's hitting you in the face. You're just trying to find your way home. Jesus says, listen, this is how I see the world. People stumbling and fumbling their way every single day, only hurting themselves, not even realizing what is hurting them. If they would only come to me, I would give them the light of life and they would never have to walk in darkness again. So this is a big statement. And I could, you know, we could spend a whole morning unpacking all this. But let me just, as I did last week, let me just explain to you, if this is true, then here's what this means for us. If Jesus is the light of the world, then Jesus is the ultimate source of life. He is the ultimate source of life. We're all looking for life, as we talked about last week. We're all looking for the things that give us meaning and significance and purpose and value and identity. And Jesus says, I am the one that gives you life. But not just meaning and significance. Just think about it this way. You know, what does spring represent for us? Spring represents this idea that the earth is getting closer to the sun, and it's beginning to warm up again. And when spring happens, why do we call it spring? Because things from the ground start to spring up. Things start to grow. Things flourish. Jesus says, when you come closer and closer to me, you will find that you will have life beginning to flourish in you like never before, guys. And I've seen this. You'll never regret taking steps closer and closer to Jesus. There will be things of new life in you and new joy and new happiness and new comfort and new peace that you can't find anywhere else. Identity, purpose, all that will begin to spring forth from you as you grow closer to Jesus. And even you'll find things will begin to burn off. That's the dangerous part. Some things in life that you're going to like, I'm hanging on to. Jesus says, no, you're going to let go of that. You got to let go of this. You got to give that up. You got to stop believing that. And things will start to burn off too. Because he's the source of life. If Jesus is the light of the world, here's another one. Jesus is the source of truth. He's the source of truth. When he declares, I am the light of the world, what he is saying is, I'm the only way for you to really understand who God is. Not that you can't know about God from other sources, from other, you know, people and prophets and creation. Those are fine and good, he would say, but those are simply a reflection of God's glory. They're like the moon. I am the glory of God. I will show you who God is in ways that all those other reflections cannot. In fact, that's what the whole point of the beginning of Hebrews is about. Hebrews says this, in the past, God spoke to our ancestors, to the prophets at many times in various ways, and those were good things, and we learned things about God. But in these last days, he spoke to us by his Son, who he appointed heir of all things, and through him also he made the universe. The Son, check this out, is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. Jesus, if you really want to know who God is, if you really want to know who your heavenly Father is, just look at me, because I am the light of the world. If Jesus is the light of the world, then Jesus is the source of our joy. He is the source of our joy. I can't tell you how many times I've been out camping, probably all the times we've gone out backpacking as men, but it rains, and it rains, and it rains, and it rains, and it's cold, you know, and then you get into your tent, and everything's wet, and, you know, and it's just miserable. You can't start a fire, and you're freezing at night. You're cold. You're wet. It's just miserable, and you're going, why did we do this again kind of thing, and then the morning comes, and the sun begins to lift up over the tree line. And you begin to feel its warmth for the first time in a long time, maybe. And you're going, oh, that's my reason to get up. Okay, I can do this. Jesus says, listen, I am your reason for joy. I am your reason to believe. I am your reason for comfort. If nothing else, I am your reason to take that next step. You know, John, when he was writing the beginning of his letter, didn't take the approach that Matthew took or Luke took when he was trying to describe the beginning of his letter about Jesus. He didn't go into the birth narrative like they did. He went a different route. He's like, how do I explain Jesus to these people? And he took a cue from Jesus' words that we looked at. Here's what he says. Here's how he starts off his letter. He's like, in him was life. And that life was the light of all mankind, not just for Jews, not just for religious people. This light is for anyone who's willing to receive it and believe it. And he says, the light shines in the darkness. And I'm telling you, John lives in a time of darkness. Rome and their oppression, King Herod, I mean, the Jewish religious, I mean, it was just a dark, dark time. And he says, there was very little hope. And yet, in that moment, the light showed up, and the light shined in the darkness, and the darkness, and this is, how do I describe this? The darkness, as dark as it was, has not overcome it. As much as Rome tried to squash that light out, as much as the Jewish system tried to squash that, you know, thing out, as much as Herod went after the babies and killed all those babies, it could not quench that light. It could not do anything. It could not overcome. Even Jesus' death on the cross could not overcome it. As dark as that was, Jesus came back from the dead, proving that his light was different. John says, what gives me hope, what gives me joy, what gives me reason to get up in the morning, even when it's completely pitch black, dark, you know, feeling in my life, is Jesus. He is my light. And I'm telling you guys, we live in a dark time, don't we? We feel like it's getting darker. I'm so glad I got Jesus to look to. He gives me hope and comfort and joy like nothing else can. And because of that, if Jesus is the light of the world, Jesus is the only one really worth and worthy of following. Are you following him? Are you following him? Are you taking your cues from him? Are you spending time with the light that gives life to all of mankind. Let me encourage you, if you've never placed your faith in Jesus, today is your day to do that. If you've been walking away and trying to look for other sense of light and sources of life, Jesus is calling you back. He says, just come to me. Everything else will let you down. Everything else, the darkness will eventually overcome. John was right. My light will never be overcome by the darkness. Because as Jesus says, I am the light